The Business on RTÉ Radio 1 with AIB. We know that your focus is on your business. That's why ours is on supporting you.
My next guest started out working on construction sites with his Irish-born father before going on to do a PhD in Cambridge. Early on in his career, he travelled extensively when he was working for a London-based construction company. He now works for Sea Alaska, which is one of 13 corporations owned by native Alaskan people. Under the umbrella of Sea Alaska, he has set up Wuchin, a $500 million business based in Seattle that specialises in ocean health. Terry Downs joins me now. Terry, running a very large business that's owned by several thousand native Alaskans is a pretty unusual shareholder base.
It is. And, you know, that has several consequences. The first one is we're owned by kind of a culture, a community, whereas most companies in the world are owned by, you know, pension funds or hedge funds. We're owned by a community of people that have a shared heritage. They can trace their history and their culture back some 12,000 years. And also 40, 50% of the people that own us are living below the poverty line. These shares could be the only asset that they have.
So you're based in Seattle. Do you travel much to Alaska to meet board members and all of that and spend a bit of time with the shareholders?
I do. I did, especially in the beginning, you know, to really get to know people and the culture. And like it, you know, the communities are remote. They're difficult to get to. So, you know, there's a huge investment in getting to know the culture and the people and the board members, because historically there's a lack of trust of outsiders.
How does it work out with, you know, the profit directive? Basically, if you were running a stock market listed company, you'd have a board and shareholders breathing down your neck to deliver results in over the next quarter. As a private company, a typical private company, you've got a bit more time to deliver on profits and grow. With this shareholder base, what's their approach to profit? I mean, is it an ideal scenario for you that they're quite relaxed about it, or they really need the money for dividends to build up their communities?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's one of the many advantages, I think, of this construct, as you alluded to. We can think long term. We don't have to be talking about our quarterly profits. And in the early days, Alaskan Native corporations like ours kind of modeled themselves on public companies. That was seen to be the benchmark. But we moved like fundamentally away from that and thought, we're unique. Let's play to that uniqueness. So we're able to think long term. I think that's incredibly important in the modern world, as I think, you know, capitalism is going to be reinvented over the next generation. And we've tried to position ourselves for that. And we run the businesses to be successful, but we're able to treat people better. You know, we give people more vacation. We're able to pay them better. We're able to be more flexible because we don't have that short-term profit focus. And there's a balance between that and, you know, building long-term value and building long-term, you know, kind of innovation, and also figuring how do we do the best for the communities. And luckily, we have many income streams beyond the businesses. But on balance, it's working because the businesses are performing well without that short-term pressure.
Terry, you grew up a long way from Seattle, a long way from Alaska. You grew up in England to an Irish family. Your parents were both from Ireland.
I grew up in Ireland and England because when I was 9, my parents got divorced and my dad moved back to Ireland. So I'd spend all my holidays in Ireland, and I went to school in England. But both my parents, like you said, were from Ireland, and their parents and their parents as far back as anyone knows. And even in England, in that era, like the 80s, their social life, because they were both farm laborers, but it's really around the church and the people they knew at church who were predominantly Irish. So it's an interesting way to grow up.
Did you have a strong Irish identity, particularly even before the breakup of your folks? Was it something that they instilled in you?
Yeah, well, you know how it is with, you know, these Irish families of that era. They had so many kids, I'm not sure they could instill anything, you know, as part of the advantage in growing up in a big family. There's not much inculcation of ideology. But yeah, without realizing it, you are learning the values of your parents. And it was very much an Irish upbringing because that's very much who they were. And they never felt at home, especially my dad, never felt at home in England. And that kind of gives me a small insight into what it's like for native people in America. because I mean, I was different from me. I went to school. I mean, I sounded more English and stuff like that. And unless you knew, you wouldn't know as Irish. But he definitely felt, you know, alienated and not valued. And he only, that's why he came home, I think. So we felt that. And I've always felt at home in Ireland for the same reason.
Did you get to go back to Ireland much and see your dad?
Yeah, like every holiday. So we kind of grew up in both. And so we go to school in England and I go back to Ireland for the holidays and I live with my dad and work with him. I worked on building sites and farms all over Ireland with him.
And was it difficult to build that relationship from a distance, you know, and when you'd come to Ireland, you know, you were on holiday, you were getting to see your dad, but was he very open to building that relationship?
Yeah, I mean, again, it was, you know, in paper you think, or people would say, and people did say your dad left you, but I didn't see it that way. And I have many, many brothers and sisters too, of course. So I didn't see it that way. I saw that, you know, I could see, even as a kid, I was young, and more as I grew up, I could really understand, you know, that it was, this is something he needed to do because he was so unhappy and he was a happier person in Ireland. He was fun. He was happy. He was engaged. He had a lot of friends. He always worked really, really hard. You know, both my parents, my dad left school at 12, my mum at 14. They're both intelligent people. They didn't have the chance to have an education or a trade. And they were wonderful parents. You know, they were a product of their situation. And he was living in a culture that, you know, he didn't feel welcome in.
Were you fairly steeped in Irish culture yourself when it came to music and things like that?
Yeah, no, we lived on a farm in the middle of nowhere, so there weren't, you know, our social life was pretty limited, and it was really limited to, not in a bad way, because we had the massive freedom of being on a farm, which was wonderful. But we're limited to the circle of people around us, and that was largely from the church. I mean, I wouldn't say my parents were religious, but church was, you know, a habit, a part of their culture. It was a social thing too. And I remember, like, at Christmas, like, loads of people from the church would come over for a drink, and the house was always full of people, and they were nearly all Irish. And the music we listened to, my dad was a huge Dubliners fan, and, you know, we'd listen to Dubliners every night. He liked to have a glass of whiskey at night because he worked hard, and I'd sit on his knee and listen to the Dubliners. I remember that as a really young kid. Yeah, so and the only place we ever went to on holiday was Ireland.
And you were living quite close to a big kind of country estate or a woodland estate that allowed you space to go off and ramble and enjoy nature at a very early age.
I was raised on a farm in England, and my dad lived on a farm in Ireland, although he mostly worked as a builder's labourer when he moved to Ireland. But in England, when I was very young, when my parents split up, you know, we had to go and live in kind of state housing, in a council estate. But when prior to that, yeah, it was a wonderful way to grow up. We had 1,000 acres to roam and play on. And although it was a farm, it was mostly woodland and rivers, and there was a trout stream. And now we'd spend the whole day roaming around there and, you know, playing and making up stories and building bows and arrows. And remember fishing with string and a safety pin, as if that would work. But, you know, we didn't care.
And you must have been pretty into school, because you went on to study science at Imperial College in London, and you did a PhD at Cambridge. Did you have any clear idea as to what you wanted to do career-wise?
When I was a kid, we lived on a farm, and the farm was not very well funded. And I'd be with my dad the whole time. Like, from a very young age, I'd be with him in the field and running and fetching tools. And 4 days into the harvest, the combine harvester would be lying in bits in the field. My dad literally would be dismantling it and trying to fix it. So the most exotic job that I ever saw was a welder. So the welder would come and fix it. And, you know, everyone was waiting for the welder to fix it, because without that, no one could work. And that's why I wanted to be a welder when I was a kid, because that was the most exotic career I'd ever seen. I was like a typical boy. I didn't take school seriously till I was about 15. I was too busy having fun and running around and, you know, playing in the woods.
Now, you went on to study science. After that, you got involved in a consultancy job, and that was about really helping to solve problems, and you travelled a lot with that job.
Yeah, after I finished my science degree, which was a great experience. And I think, you know, science teaches you to think, in my opinion. You're always trying to break the hypothesis. You're always trying to eliminate bias. So the whole thing about science, especially research, is thinking about your bias, because your bias is leading you to the same answer every time, and you want to find a different answer. So it's a great thought process in my mind. And after that, I worked for a big company, and I worked in the kind of strategic planning department. I worked for them rather than being a consultant for them. But yeah, they would send me all over the world to solve problems, and you know, that they really didn't want to solve. And in essence, they weren't very good listeners. This was mostly in emerging markets and kind of interesting parts of the world. And although I'd had a very, you know, kind of secluded upbringing and never traveled as a kid, I read a lot as a kid. I was always fascinated by nature. I was fascinated by Africa and South America. And I really wanted to go to those places. And this job enabled that.
And that idea that maybe some of your bosses or colleagues or the corporate culture that you were in, they didn't necessarily take these people seriously enough. And if you actually sat down and talked to them and listened to them from their perspective, a lot of these things could be solved.
Well, yeah. And even if, you know, if you're trying to force someone to do something they don't want to do, I mean, how can you do it if they don't want to do it? Especially if you're 8,000 miles away. It's a different language, it's a different culture, and they don't feel listened to. It just becomes a power play, and that's what they tried to use. But of course, it doesn't work.
What kind of problems were there? What kind of issues where that would arise?
It'd be often around, you know, an acquisition they wanted to do, didn't want to do, an investment, people, performance, how they're going to expand, those types of things, how they really wanted to move their business forward or didn't want to move their business forward. What I'd heard before I went down there would be very different from what I heard when they were there. And I think it was only because I was listening. And I think a lot of that comes from, you know, being raised in two different cultures, right? Just learning that there's more than one way to think about stuff without being taught that, you know, and reading it in black and white, just experiencing it in very simple ways. My dad very much came from that era where you took care of each other in Ireland. I mean, people would support, even if you weren't working, I mean, you would not work cheaper than someone else who just to get work. If you would, there's this sense of solidarity, you know, this working class solidarity that, you know, in the Thatcher years, as you well know, did not exist in England.
And what about Silasca and Wu Qin and the job? How did that come about?
Gradually, is from working, solving little problems, I over the years, you know, started working, helping turn around companies, you know, and I would like to think the right way, and helping companies had a serious problem, you know, fix it and fix it once and for all rather than a short term fix. And I'd done that, and I've been doing that for a company in the US that was bankrupt, and we turned it around and made it viable and reinvented it. And I got a call from a recruiter that Sealaska was looking for someone to help them. They were struggling and they wanted someone to help them really rethink their destiny. And it was, to me, an opportunity to do something really different. I was living in Seattle. I had kids here and I didn't want to move. And so it kind of ticked all the boxes.
And what does the name Wu Qin mean?
It means working together is probably the closest translation. But as I spent a lot of time soaking up the culture in the early years from people that were raised speaking Tlingit, and that's very unusual now, it means like working in harmony with everything around you. It means being conscious of your place in the world. And working together, not just with other people, but with the environment and listening to the environment and living in harmony with it rather than trying to control it.
So what are the different aspects to the business?
So we call it Ocean Health, and fundamentally we're focused on three things. What we call low impact protein, so getting people to eat more protein, but fundamentally from the ocean that has a lower carbon and freshwater footprint, because wild seafood, that's probably a 50th of the carbon footprint of, say, beef. So, but it's underconsumed because often the quality is not as fresh as it should be. So we're rebuilding that supply chain and dedicated to get people to eat more low-impact food. And then we're also, you know, working to get clean energy from our oceans, especially offshore wind, and then cleaning up pollution in our water. So understanding and cleaning up pollution in groundwater and in our ocean water. So those are the three fundamental elements to the business.
With the community, Terry, the Native American community there, they have land, they have resources from which, you know, this company has been built. Does that include ocean territory as well?
No, it doesn't, unfortunately. When they settled with the US government, they gave up rights to the ocean. They gave up rights to fisheries. Some native groups in the world do have rights, fishing rights, but they gave those up and instead they took land. And so when we're working for offshore wind, we're working for Ørsted and we're working all over the world. Fundamentally, we're characterizing the geology of the ocean floor to help those wind farms make decisions about where they build, how they anchor them, how they bring the cables back to shore. And that's a lot of the work that the company we bought in Ireland does too, Causeway, that we bought in Ireland last year.
That's an Antrim company.
That's right. They do geotechnical work. So basically, they're characterizing the Earth's geology, and then both in land and under the ocean.
So what about the challenges then that Native Alaskans face there? I mean, you know, when people talk about Native Americans in general, it's a kind of a mixed bag stereotypically. People talk about, for example, in some parts of the United States, they have casinos and gambling rights and they appear to be doing well. In other parts of the United States, they have huge social problems and poverty. In Alaska, a lot of the debate seems to be about resources, but I would imagine that there are big social problems in those communities.
There are enormous social problems in those communities, and they're complicated. I mean, they're a consequence of history and location. Kids growing up in these communities have a colossal disadvantage, I think. I mean, they have the cultural connection and the richness of their culture, which I think is incredibly valuable. But they get so much messaging in their childhood that they're not valued. You know, just like my dad did, you know, and I'm not equating the two, but it can kind of relate to a degree that from, you know, from media, because of racism in America, because of their situation, they get a lot of messaging that they're not valuable. And I think to a kid, that's an incredibly damaging thing. And it leads to addiction and all the other things that we're struggling with in those communities. Opioid addiction is a chronic problem in our communities. And, you know, although the money helps, and you're asking about money earlier, and we do spend money on dividends, and that helps because these people are living, you know, close to the poverty line often. I think we have to come at it with, you know, many solutions. This is a problem that's long in the making, and it's going to be long in the solving. And so that was a large part of the inspiration to build a company around ocean health, a company that's informed by their unique history and culture, something they can relate to and be proud of and be part of, and all the unusual things they learn growing up in remote areas, like how to navigate on the ocean, how to deal with remote logistics, how to deal with, you know, difficult climates, how to deal in the wild, because it's, you know, it's full of bears and wolves. All those skills are invaluable in the work we do. I mean, if you come and work in Wall Street, they're not that helpful. But if you're working on ocean research or on a geotechnical rig, then those skills that they have by virtue of their upbringing and their culture are incredibly valuable.
You mentioned there about being out in the wilderness and bears. It is a pretty wild. I've been to Alaska, and I spent 3 days going down the Chitna River on a raft, among other things.
Oh, but awesome.
There are a lot of bears there.
Yeah.
That's not something that spooks you?
As you know, about the most dangerous thing we have is a hedgehog. So I can't say I grew up understanding how to deal with bears. But, you know, it's like anything in life. You learn about it. And there's things I definitely wouldn't do, like that other people do. I'd be more careful doing, largely because I have kids. You just have to be deeply respectful and thoughtful and understand the bears don't want to mess with you any more than you want to mess with them, really. And if you respect that and you follow a few guidelines and protocols, you're usually okay.
And when you're maybe at the AGM or the shareholders meeting, or you're dealing with members of the board or whatever, in the early days, did you make any complete faux pas where you just sort of culturally said the wrong thing or hadn't a clue what was going on?
I'm sure I did. I mean, whether they were when I told me about it. But in general, I noticed when I talked to the elders that they talk very differently. And if you ask them a question, they just ignore you. I think the message is not that they're being rude, it's just like, you know, shut up and listen, you might learn something. And they communicate in a different way. And historically, they've communicated through stories, and they don't tell you what those stories mean. You're supposed to think about them and what they mean to you. So it's an interesting way of thinking that I think, you know, we all were very close to one time, but it's having the patience to really work through that rather than, you know, the modern corporate age where time is money, the modern world's getting busier and busier, and I've only got 20 minutes. That sort of stuff just doesn't work.
It's certainly a lot different to a standard slide presentation, I'm sure. Terry Downes, Chief Executive of Wuchin, thank you very much for joining us on the program.
My pleasure. Thank you, Richard.